The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Guardian Daily. It's Wednesday, June the 4th, 2008. I'm Esther Adley and this is what's coming up on today's podcast.
Tonight I can stand here and say that I will be the Democratic nominee for the President of the United States of America.
The results are in from the last two Democratic primaries.
This has been a long campaign and I will be making no decisions tonight.
Who said the Olympic spirit was under threat? We reveal the 57 rules that all foreigners must stick to if they want to attend this year's Games in China.
No demonstration will be allowed without police approval, and anyone who tries to conduct an unauthorised demonstration will have to take full legal responsibility.
They were ordered 13 years ago and have cost hundreds of millions of pounds, but guess what? The Chinook helicopters, urgently needed by British troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, still aren't safe to fly.
The gold standard procurement cock-up and one of the worst procurement contracts of all time.
But first, the headlines and a look at today's papers with Sandy Warr.
Barack Obama has claimed victory in the contest to be the Democrat Party candidate for President of the United States. In the last two primaries, he won Montana and Hillary Clinton won South Dakota. But Obama believes he now has enough delegates to win at the party convention. He told his supporters in Minnesota why he thought he'd won the long battle.
Thousands of miles have been traveled. Millions of voices have been heard. And because of what you said, because you decided the change must come to Washington, because you believed that this year must be different than all the rest.
Senator Barack Obama claiming victory to take on the Republican's John McCain in November. But Hillary Clinton's not given up, though she congratulated Obama in her speech. We'll have the full story later in Guardian Daily. The 22-year-old man arrested after an explosion in an Exeter restaurant 10 days ago has been charged with preparing to commit an act of terrorism and with possession of an explosive substance. Nicky Riley has been in hospital since the explosion and will now appear in court. Police say two other men remain in custody while they continue their investigation. The Ministry of Defence has been accused of a series of mistakes by the National Audit Office. A report says the ministry spent hundreds of millions of pounds on 8 Chinook helicopters, but they're still not airworthy 13 years after being ordered. They've been kept in cold storage in Britain, while troops in Afghanistan have had to use faulty helicopters, which the ministry admits has put soldiers at risk. We'll have more later in the programme. The chief prosecutor at the International Criminal Court claims that the whole state apparatus of Sudan is implicated in war crimes. He said that he'd uncovered evidence that high officials in the government have been involved in atrocities in Darfur. He said he had evidence of government connections to rape, killing, torture and bombing, burning and looting. Half the morning papers put Barack Obama on their front pages. The Times says Obama waits on the threshold of history, while The Guardian puts it, Obama ends Clinton's White House dream. The Sun and The Mirror continue to follow Paul Gascoigne, warning that he must quit drinking or he will die. And most of the back pages laugh at Chelsea owner Roman Abramovich because Milan's Carlo Ancelotti has refused to become his club manager in spite of a huge money offer. More on the day's stories plus breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Never mind false dawns, this has been a story of false sunsets. But today, it really does seem as if it's all over for Hillary Clinton. Last night, the Democratic race officially came to an end with the results of the final two primary votes. Our correspondents have been following both candidates and report on a dramatic and potentially historic night in US politics.
This is Suzanne Goldenberg in St. Paul, Minnesota. Barack Obama has won the Democratic Party nomination. He now becomes the first African-American to clinch the nomination of a major political party, the first African-American to have a really viable shot of winning the White House when he goes into the general election against John McCain next November. It's also a triumph of a smaller sort for Obama. He has really established himself as a political giant killer. He defeated Hillary Clinton, who was once seen as an inevitable candidate. despite being a relative newcomer to the political scene. It was hard to credit tonight in the cheering, enthusiastic crowd that just 4 years ago, most people had never heard of Obama. He hadn't even been elected to the U.S. Senate.
Tonight, we mark the end of one historic journey with the beginning of another. Because of you, tonight I can stand here and say that I will be the Democratic nominee for the President of the United States of America.
What he's doing from this point on is laying out the groundwork for his general election campaign against John McCain. He showed us some of the brush strokes tonight. He's talking much stronger in his language on issues like defense. He talked about tough diplomacy. He talked about the need for the Iraqi leaders to step up to fill their responsibilities. So he's trying to make sure that he can stand his ground on military issues and on defense issues. He's also going after McCain on the economy, making it clear that he, Obama, is someone who has interests of working Americans at heart. So tonight was really the night where the Obama campaign hoped to pivot towards the general election. Unfortunately for Obama, they can't quite do that entirely. Clinton has not yet conceded the Democratic nomination. She won one of the two contests, the state of South Dakota, while Obama took Montana. And on the strength of that last victory and running a fairly close second, Clinton appears to be maneuvering to try and get something out of the Obama campaign. Her ambitions might go as high as a vice presidential post, or she might want jobs for her supporters in the next administration, or she might simply want Obama to adopt some of her policies. Whatever is going on now, the Obama campaign is quite anxious to keep the maneuvering civil and behind the scenes. The message from David Axelrod, his chief strategist on down, was that this was a time for the Democrats to unite. So for Barack Obama, it's a time to be very conciliatory towards Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, he's showing no quarter for John McCain. The general election campaign started tonight.
I'm Ed Pilkington. I'm standing in Baruch College in New York, where Senator Hillary Clinton is expected to arrive shortly. The crowd here is already large and full right up to the top of this gymnasium. And there's the largest bank of television cameras I've seen in a long while. There must be about 150 cameras and many, many more reporters here tonight. They're here, of course, because it's going to be a big night. The question on everybody's mind, will she or won't she? Will she concede tonight, or will we have to wait till later in the week before she almost certainly does so? That's what everyone's wondering. The senator's due to turn up here shortly, and we'll no doubt find out soon. It's an emotional night here in New York for Clinton supporters, and I've been talking to several of them about how they look back on the campaign and what they think the senator from New York has achieved in all these past weeks.
I've been following her since November. I've been doing campaign for her. I'm a huge supporter of Hillary.
Why?
Because she's the best candidate. She has 35 years of experience. She's the best candidate. She's going to bring the truth back with the 60 day, and she's going to fix this broken economy, and she's going to have universal health care.
Is this a sad night for you?
I cannot call until she says that she lost. I will not believe until she says it. But I feel in my heart that she's going to be number one, and Obama is going to be number two.
I am a supporter of Hillary Clinton since 1992, and I supported Hillary Clinton now because I think she would have been more qualified and easier to defeat John McCain. But I'm a Democrat, and I will vote for a Democrat anytime versus a Republican.
She has been maybe the greatest woman this nation has known. What she has achieved is sticking up for her country and herself. She has followed through when everybody beat her up. She stands tall.
Are you sad tonight?
No, sir, I'm not sad at all. I just say the fight continues. We're going to Denver.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Chelsea Clinton, President Bill Clinton, and Senator Hillary Clinton.
And here she comes. She's coming out now to face her fans one more time. Hillary Clinton.
I want to start tonight by congratulating Senator Obama and his supporters on the extraordinary race that they have run. And our party and our democracy is stronger and more vibrant as a result. So we are grateful. Now the question is, where do we go from here? And given how far we've come and where we need to go as a party, it's a question I don't take lightly. This has been a long campaign, and I will be making no decisions tonight.
Well, we now know the answer to that question. Will she or won't she? She won't. She has said she will not make any decisions tonight. There is no conceding here in New York. We'll have to wait for later in the week to watch what she does next.
That was Suzanne Goldenberg and Ed Pilkington. And for full analysis and reaction to last night's results and what it means for the presidential race, see guardian.co.uk/America. Also on The Guardian's website today, Martin Kettle writes on the 42-day detention limit debacle. See guardian.co.uk/comment. Green guru Leo Hickman suggests 10 ways to save money and save the planet at guardian.co.uk/environment. And we're gearing up for Euro 2008. Go to guardian.co.uk/sport to hear James Richardson and Barry Glendinning's preview show ahead of the tournament. When 8 Chinook helicopters were first ordered by the Ministry of Defence in 1995, it forgot to check they were safe to fly. They weren't. In the 18 years since, the MOD has spent almost £500 million trying to upgrade them and fix them, but the helicopters are still too dangerous to take to the air. It's all been condemned by an investigation by the National Audit Office, and I asked David Henke in our Westminster office what exactly the report had uncovered.
Well, basically, it's found that 13 years ago, we ordered 8 special operation Chinooks, which could be used in the war against the Taliban, and they're still not in service. When the procurement order was placed for these, they forgot to include measures to check whether they were airworthy to British standards. When they were delivered, they weren't. The result was they then had to be stored, and they are still stored in air-conditioned hangars in Britain, while they're desperately needed in Afghanistan to ferry the troops. And to overcome the problem, to make it worse, the government converted some sort of Chinooks that weren't for special operations for night flying. But these have actually put the troops in some danger because the night flying screens obscure the pilot's frontal vision and his landing vision. So the planes in use at the moment are not really sort of best for purpose. And what has happened since then is that there have been 2 attempts to upgrade these helicopters. £215 million was put aside to bring them up to sort of top standard. But this was found to take too long, so they're now being downgraded, i.e. they're stripping out some equipment to make them more a basic helicopter with the hope that the first one can fly in 2009, 14 years after it was ordered.
It would almost be funny if it wasn't so catastrophic. I mean, what's the reaction been to this succession of revelations?
Well, frankly, the chairman of the Commons Public Accounts Committee, who are going to call the MOD to explain themselves over this, has used unparliamentary language by describing it as a gold standard procurement cock-up and one of the worst procurement contracts of all time. It was so bad. And frankly, they're absolutely shocked and disgusted. The Ministry of Defence has tried to defend itself by saying, well, actually, we're having to use Chinooks much more heavily than we ever anticipated in Afghanistan, and we will actually get these in the air in the end. But I don't think this is going to wash very well with both the opposition, and certainly not before the all-party MPs on the Public Accounts Committee, when the Ministry of Defence are going to be, I think, hauled over the coals for this scandal.
Well, you mentioned one of the modifications that had been made that had actually worsened the situation. I mean, what exactly is the situation for troops on the ground who are presumably waiting for these Chinooks quite earnestly?
Well, at the moment, they're having to rely on these souped-up versions of the Mark II helicopters to take them anywhere. So they really are being let down. There's also a shortage of helicopters as well. And the Ministry of Defence, to give it credit, did try around the entire world to see if it could get some more Chinooks and couldn't get any anywhere, and has ended up temporarily using some other helicopters, Merlin ones, that are not up to the high standard of the Chinook, which they've basically diverted from the Royal Danish Air Force to go to Afghanistan.
Now, Max Mosley is no stranger to controversy. Hitler, after all, attended the wedding of his parents, Sir Oswald Mosley and Diana Mitford. But when a newspaper alleged in March that he'd dressed up as a Nazi to take part in a sadomasochistic orgy, it seemed it might be too much for the International Automobile Federation, of which he is president. Mosley, by the way, admits the orgy, but denies any Nazi element. Yesterday, however, the FIA voted that he could stay on as president. I spoke to Richard Williams, reporting for The Guardian from a noisy Paris cafe.
He won the vote, probably not surprisingly, because he's a very effective lobbyist. He won the vote by 103-55, but a lot of the delegates of some of the biggest motoring organisations in the world went away very angry that he'd won the vote.
The background to this, Richard, as you mentioned, was the allegations in March in the News of the World that he'd partaken in an orgy. Obviously, one element to that was the suggestion that this had sort of had Nazi-style features, which had particular piquancy given his family's history. What was his reaction to that allegation, and is that the critical factor in the vote being raised against him?
Well, Max is, of course, the son of the late Oswald Mosley, the British fascist leader before and after the war, and of Diana Mosley, who was a big fan of Hitler. So the Nazi allegations were particularly hurtful and damaging to him, and he resisted them strongly. And in fact, he got a prominent barrister to investigate the matter at his expense, or the FIA's expense, excuse me, and to speak yesterday to all the members of the General Assembly, and to tell them that, in his view, the story was unjustified, or the Nazi allegations were unjustified, that this was, if you like, a plain vanilla sadomasochistic session rather than anything with sort of darker overtones. And enough of them seemed to be convinced by it. In fact, quite even the people who voted against him felt that was a justifiable plea. They just think that that the revelations of themselves were bad enough without the Nazi slur.
Have we had any reaction from Max Mosley to the vote?
Not at all. Mosley refused to appear or speak after the vote. It's said that he won't be making any public appearances until after the conclusion of his breach of privacy case against the News of the World, which will be heard in July. And I think he's probably going to keep his head down until then. What he's said is that he will relinquish all the public duties of the presidency. He'll leave those to his two deputies while continuing with the actual work of the president for the next year and a half.
Mosley may have lived to fight another day, but I suppose some might argue that it's not exactly what international motoring needs, this kind of episode. What happens next, Richard?
Well, the subtext to all this is something called the Concorde Agreement, which is the agreement whereby the Formula One teams compete under the aegis of the FIA. The Concorde Agreement is a secret document, which the current one's expired, and a new one's being negotiated. And it's a very, very important thing, and that is what Mosley wants to retain control of. You know, it's not something we're ever allowed to know about, but I think that's what he's going to be devoting the next few months to, frankly. And for all Bernie Eccleston's words about feeling that he should step down, I think Eccleston will probably be very pleased that his old ally remains in position so that they can negotiate the new agreement together.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Still to come, we have a rare interview with the 88-year-old sitar legend Ravi Shankar, in which he talks about his music, his friendship with George Harrison, and his legacy.
What I do is improvise on the spot. I am very proud of that area as an improvisator. And it's such a joy, you know, and to be performing and doing something which I have never done.
But first, bad news if you're subversive, you've got an STD or you drink Pepsi. Don't expect to get into the Olympics in 2 months' time. China has released its rules of acceptable and unacceptable behaviour it expects from spectators in order to preserve the social order of the Games, including a ban on wearing unapproved T-shirts. John Dennis spoke to The Guardian's Jonathan Watts in Beijing and asked him about the rules China is using to promote that famous Olympic spirit of fraternity.
They say things like no sleeping in public spaces such as parks or under bridges or on the side of roads, because that might upset the social order and create a bad image for the host city. That one is kind of cute and perhaps not so sinister at all. Some of the regulations that are likely to cause more concern to human rights activists are those that say no demonstration will be allowed without police approval, and anyone who tries to conduct an unauthorized demonstration will have to take full legal responsibility. Also that no publications can be shown and no slogans can be shouted that have any religious, political or racial message, and no content that might harm the political or economic interests of China will be allowed into the country. So those latter topics are the ones where we'll probably see the Chinese government use regulations to stop people like Amnesty International, Free Tibet, and others that the Chinese government considers hostile to themselves.
John, are the rules listed on the Olympic organisers' website all existing regulations, or are there any new ones there?
This is a compilation of old laws and newly passed regulations that all apply to Chinese citizens as well. The idea of putting on the website, the Olympic website, is just to remind anyone who's thinking of visiting China of what kind of behaviour is expected of them when they're over here.
Spectators at the Games aren't allowed to drink anything other than Coca-Cola, which is one of the Olympic sponsors.
That's right. This is actually not one of the regulations, but at a separate press conference today, the Olympic organisers spelled out the rules that they want to apply to stop what's called ambush marketing or ambush advertising. And by that, they mean that they've received a stack of money from their official sponsors, and they will do everything they can to protect those sponsors' interests from rivals. And if, for example, their Pepsi Cola paid for 500 people to all turn up with Pepsi bottles and try to drink at the same time as a sort of semi-advertisement, the host would also have the authority to stop that.
John, you're speaking to us from the back of a Beijing taxi. What visible signs are there that the Chinese capital is preparing for the attention of the world to be focused on it in a couple of months' time?
The visible signs are everywhere, and they're changing all the time. You might be able to hear in the background some cranes and construction workers. We've had this soundtrack for the past 4 or 5 years, as new buildings are erected, new roads are built, new subway lines are constructed. And by and large, the really big construction projects are mostly done now. And so what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is this beautification campaign kicking in. And formerly dusty streets are now lined with pots and pots and pots of pretty little blue, red and orange flowers. It really is an almost alien Beijing from the one that I arrived in 5 years ago. And I think it's even strange for many of the residents who wonder why there are so many flowers in a city that already suffers severe water shortages.
He's undoubtedly one of the greatest musicians of the late 20th century and influenced many of the others, changing the way that Indian music is viewed around the world. And tonight, Ravi Shankar, who's now 88, plays at the Barbican in a tour he's calling A Farewell to Europe. In a rare interview, he spoke to John O'Mahony.
Beatle George Harrison called him the godfather of world music. Violinist Yehudi Menuhin compared him to Mozart. But away from the adulation, Ravi Shankar is a musician with an astonishing depth of knowledge of his instrument, the sitar, and the Indian musical tradition in general.
With the classical Indian music, we don't have, like Western music, written compositions. So as far as I am concerned, it's always new. Every performance is a new thing, though we choose some particular ragas. Ragas are the melody forms. There are thousands of them. So I always try to choose a new raga which I have not played before, maybe. So that way it is always new. And what I do is improvise on the spot. And I am very proud of that area as an improvisator. And it's such a joy, you know, and to be performing and doing something which I have never done. Though it is based on some ideas like the raga, some format, of course. But what I do is on the spot. And that's the greatest thrill for me as well as the listener, because it is like cooking fresh food and serving it hot.
At the same time, Indian music also has very strict rules and codes, with complicated rhythms and scales, as well as other aspects that will strike a Westerner as distinctly esoteric.
These ragas, as I said, there are thousands of them, and they're all connected with different time of the day, like sunrise, very early morning, or late night, or sunset. Then what we follow are also the rasa, R-A-S-A, rasa. It means sentiment or mood. We have got principal nine moods that all our art forms show. And they are, you know, anything like tremendous peaceful. Within that peaceful, there are many variations like praying or just a feeling of emptiness sitting on a ocean side or, you know, different moods of tranquility.
At the age of 88, Shankar has changed the way Indian music is regarded around the world. His achievements have been enormous, perhaps unrepeatable. But many see his daughter Anushka, also a sitar player, who regularly performs alongside him, as his rightful heir.
So do you see passing on the mantle, in a way, passing on the generation to Anushka?
Well, I don't think of that way. But I guess I have done it in many ways. I am still doing it. You know, still I sit with her and give her new things and information that I didn't give before. And it's fantastic. You see, this is what happens with our music, because it is not a written down set in a book. It goes on growing.
And that's it for today's podcast. Producing were Andy Duckworth and Phil Maynard. I'm Esther Adley. Thanks for listening.
Downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.